This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we are continuing our retrospective on Quentin Tarantino, looking at every single movie that he's directed leading up to his work on Star Trek 14, hopefully. And yeah. Today we're going to take a look at the sixth film by Quentin Tarantino, Inglourious Basterds. But before we do that, just a little bit of news, something which, I don't know, is pretty cool. It was revealed when the credits rolled, I guess. I hadn't seen it up until now, that the director of this week's episode of Star Trek Discovery, episode 12, Vaulting Ambition, is Hanell Culpepper, who's a director who has done lots and lots of TV. She's done everything from Flash and Gotham to Hawaii Five-O to Parenthood, every show. And, she did a hell of a job on Discovery, if you ask me. I mean, just the first shot. It's like a visual effects shot of, like, this shuttle pod leaving the ship. It's so awesome. Because you see, you're, like, basically following the ship. You're kind of, like, attached to the ship, and then you see it, like, come out of the bay, and then you see the Shenzhou just like disappear into the back. That's really cool. Anyway, yeah. She did a good job. But one of the things which is really cool, which is noteworthy, because like I take it you haven't been watching After Trek, right?
No, I have not.
Okay. Last week they had Ted Sullivan, a writer producer, on, and he was talking about how, you know, one of the things that he's really proud of working on the show is the amount of diversity behind the scenes, and how, you know, there's lots and lots of women, and but Hanell Culpepper is the first black woman to direct an episode of Star Trek, which is crazy to think that it's taken, you know, 52 years to do, but hey, that's pretty great.
That is great, and I agree with you. It seems like an awfully long stretch for this to, you know, that's kind of, I think it probably takes you off guard, because you're like, that can't be right.
Right.
You can't possibly be right, but it's apparently right.
It is. There are very, very few women who have directed for Star Trek. I mean, I just saw the list, and it's like, pretty sure it's single digits, you know, which is insane. But, you know, two on Discovery already, so that's great. And, you know, Culpepper, just for you know, nerds like us, she also has a little short film that she did back in 2005 up on her website called How to Stand in Line for Star Wars. It's literally just sort of like it's done like one of those like 50s instructional videos, you know, like, or not videos, like films, you know, like,
yeah.
Oh, you know, how to stand in line for Star Wars, you know, first make
how
sure.
How does zinc contribute to your daily life?
Exactly.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. And I mean, it looks like she has footage from, you know, episode 1 and episode 2. I don't think she has any from episode 3. I think maybe it came out like right before.
Yeah, if she's doing Standing in Line and it's released in 2005, it was probably released before episode 3 came out. Beforehand.
Oh, yeah, before, yeah. But people were standing in line for episode 3.
Well, Yes, no, I know, but I'm like saying that like she's talking about standing in line.
Oh, so
and
that
so the payoff is that like you've learned how to stand in line for Star Wars, and now let's go see Episode 3.
Right, right, and you know it's cool. I mean, it's cool just seeing you know all the people from. I mean, as someone who did stand in line, I know you stood in line a lot longer than I did. How long were you in line for Episode 1?
Oh well, Episode 1, for the camping out, I slept overnight on a sidewalk. Yes.
See, I was going to do that. I wanted to do that so badly, but I didn't really realize the culture. I didn't realize that I could be like, hey, man, is it okay if I go to McDonald's for a minute? And they'd be like, yeah, sure, you know, because I couldn't get anyone to do it with me. So, like, I timed it out, and I'm like, I can, you know, hold my bladder for 7 hours. So I'm going to go 7 hours beforehand, and by the time that I did, like, the line was literally, like, 2 blocks away, but
I remember camping out overnight for Return of the Jedi when it was re-released in 97, and it was brutal because it was like chilly and rainy and miserable, and like everybody was unhappy, and there was somebody who tried to they like left a walking stick with their website on it, you know, because websites were just becoming a thing, and like left. And then came back the following morning after like sleeping in a warm, dry bed. And the crowd turned on them and kicked them out. And they were like, no, you are not here. You get out of line right now. Like, that's how miserable the weather was.
I can't believe there were lines for Jedi in 97.
It was to see the Uptown Theater, the theater that everybody wants to see things on, that screen in DC. That was the theater. That people were camping out for. It was nowhere near the line for Episode 1. Yeah, nowhere near that.
I was going to say, I went to McClure Court on opening day of Star Wars in 97, and the theater wasn't even full, you know?
Uptown was like one of those old school movie palaces with like balconies and like a giant, like it was, there was only one screen in the whole place, and the screen was like the wall of a building sort of thing. And so people, you know, loved to go to it. And you know, I mean, early days of fandom and stuff like that, it was DC and we're stupid and you know, got nothing better to do, I guess. I don't know. I mean, seriously, if I could time travel back to that young lad sleeping on a sidewalk, I'd be like, dude, what are you doing? They got plenty of tickets.
Well, you know, but it was still fun. It was still fun. I don't know. And you know, there is the whole like now that there's reserved seating, it's completely like I saw people for Episode 8 were lined up outside of the Chinese theater like a week in advance, and it's like you literally have your seat reserved. Like, yes. What is it that you're doing? But you know, like here, this was, and I didn't realize this, like, you know, this was all like LA based. They're like, there's the Chinese theater line and then there's the Westwood theater line, you know, and it sounded like, you know, like the people in the Westwood line were like, the Chinese theater is for the tourists, you know, the real people want to come to Westwood, which I didn't know about. And there's like this one guy, he's like, I want row P, seat 7. That's the most acoustically perfect seat in the theater. That's where Steven Spielberg insists on sitting when he goes to this theater, you know, like that sort of thing. And, you know, he's like, I need to get in there first because I need that seat, you know, which I can relate to. I am certainly someone who has done that on numerous occasions, but...
Well, I mean, the seat definitely matters. I remember, gosh, man, it was, you know, it's not even about a Star Wars movie or anything. I used to be a very big stickler for the movie theater that was finally put in the, you know, the town where I originally grew up and all of that stuff. In the main auditorium, 7th row was the row to what, like any row beyond the 7th row sucked. It was terrible. But I always had, not always, but I would have people with me who were like, no, that's too close. I want to sit closer to the back. And I'd be there with a group of people. And I'd be like, okay. And they would go sit in their spot. And I'd be like, I'll see you after the film. I'm not going to sit there.
I definitely know that. You know, when I was a projectionist, you know, they're, you know, in theater number 7, which is where I screened all the movies, you know, because you got to watch them ahead of time to make sure there's nothing wrong with them. You know, we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, sometimes like employees would come or whatever to watch movies too. And I literally had a masking taped X on the bottom of my seat and no one could sit in that seat. That was my seat. And then when the seats were taken out and replaced with, you know, new and improved seats, I was like, can I get that seat right there? And the owner was like, yeah, you can have that seat. So I do now have that seat. Even, you know, this is how possessive I was of the seat. I have it in my living room right over there. Right.
You live with a very patient woman, Mike. That's all I'm going to say about that. But I love that, and I applaud it. I think it's great.
Anyway, just thought that was cool. Thought it should be noted. So, yeah. All right, let's move on to our feature film for today, which is Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. This is a movie which came out in 2009, about 2 years after Death Proof. And, you know, Tarantino was really starting to increase his output at this point in time. He got over that hump, you know, after Jackie Brown, you know, into Kill Bill. And then, you know, there was nothing stopping him, I guess, from this point on. And, yeah, do you want to give a description of this movie?
It is an historical fiction film, an alternate history, if you will, a tale of Nazi hunters that are set loose during World War II with the express purpose of, in the words of their leader, killing Nazis. And, you know, the other people that they encounter along the way who are also interested in killing Nazis. And, you know, as we love to say, hijinks ensue.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. You know, it's a movie. Well, I think it definitely, you have to say, it takes place in the movie universe, right? Because
yes, definitely.
The events that unfold are certainly contradictory to history.
Yes.
But yeah, in a lot of ways, though, it's played a lot, I think, straighter than a lot of his other movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's interesting because, like, this movie was, like, he had talked about doing this movie for years, and it was really kind of a question of, like, well, what form is it going to take? Because he talked about how, you know, his idea was like 4 hours long. Then at one point he was thinking about splitting it up into two volumes like he did with Kill Bill. And he was going to call, you know, like the first one, you know, Once Upon a Time in Nazi-Occupied France, you know, which ends up being the title of the first chapter. Because one of the things which is kind of unique about this, and you know, we're going to see this over his next few movies or his remaining few movies, is, you know, it's a Western. It's a Western that takes place in World War II, but it's a Western that takes place in France, you know? but it's still, like, in terms of, you know, the sort of, like, genre cliches and stuff like that, it's a Western through and through. And
yeah,
that's pretty cool. But it's sprawling. I mean, and that's the thing. At one point he was saying it was going to be like a novel or like a miniseries, or he didn't know how to condense it. And then when he finally did, he's like, okay, I've got it into like 2.5 hours, you know, by basically chopping out like tons and tons of stuff. And it's like, okay, is this just like a fraction of what this idea was? Are we going to see something more, you know, somewhere down the line or whatever? But the end result, I think, is like an extremely taut movie, which is one of his best.
I completely agree. I think it's amazing. I mean, you know, to speak to your point about the Western, there's, you know, in the beginning of the film, there's a shot that's a straight up homage to The Searchers.
Yeah.
Like it still blows my mind seeing it again this time. I'm like, This is so crazy that he lifted it straight out and paid homage to John Ford in a film about fictional Nazi hunters. Like, that's just so incredibly Tarantino, you know, through and through. And the fact that he, like, I view this as the thing that makes Inglourious Basterds work so well is the fact that this is the type of movie you see in your head that nobody else sees when they don't like some sort of schlocky, low-budget, grindhouse type of movie. What I mean by that is that when you're younger and you see a movie that is that schlocky type of alternate history or something like that, sometimes somebody else is sitting there with you or somebody older than you is watching and is like, yeah, okay, that's all right. But this is the movie you saw in your head. This is how cool it was. This is how amazing it was to watch this sort of thing. And like, that's, you know, I think that contributes to why the characters are so much bigger than life and why this feels part and parcel like it belongs with Death Proof, with Kill Bill. It belongs with those movies, even though it is in large part, I think, a perfection of them. Like, he drops those other conceits of I'm going to do sections that are a tribute to every single, you know, in homage to every single type of film that I've ever watched, or I'm going to have a missing reel, or I'm going to do a, like, he just makes that movie and he says, this is like, it again comes across like this is the type of movie that if somebody who was one of those directors from the 1970s had the money, this is what they would have made.
Yeah, you know, it took me a while to sort of wrap my head around this one because there is a thing that happens like post Jackie Brown where Tarantino almost like abandons what sort of like made his movies like original in a sense in terms of like style. Like Pulp Fiction feels like a complete movie that just exists in its own world, right? Whereas with Kill Bill to start, like it feels like, okay, he's kind of, you know, as we talked about, you know, riffing on movies that have come before, you know, and like you're saying, you know, in terms of the style, like, you know, doing a sequence that takes place in China, which is, you know, like degraded, like, 3 or 4 generations in order to make it look like a movie that would play in like a grindhouse film, you know, theater, because it was like a bootleg 35 millimeter print that was taken off of like another crappy print, you know what I mean? Instead of being just like this pristine image. And, you know, Death Proof obviously takes that to a whole other level. And with Inglourious Basterds, I think partially because of the subject matter, partially because it is like an alternate history, and because it is like a Western, like I for the longest time sort of like lumped it into that category. But like, you know, the more you watch it and everything, the more I watch it, you know, the more I sort of realize like, no, it's not that. And I mean, I'm not necessarily critical of what he's doing in Kill Bill and Death Proof. You know, I think that it's fine for those movies. Obviously, I love, you know, especially Kill Bill, but it in some ways it's kind of like, yeah, I wish that he would just kind of like play it straight in a sense, though, instead of, you know, like sort of like playing to the form. And, you know, like that was one of the things with Kill Bill. I love the way that Kill Bill looks, but, you know, and this is something we haven't talked about, he got Robert Richardson to photograph that movie. And Robert Richardson is one of the best cinematographers on the planet. He photographed, I mean, so tons of movies. JFK, you know, Natural Born Killers, Bringing Out the Dead, you know, I mean, it's like just some of the best looking movies ever. And here he is, you know, working with Tarantino, and Tarantino's like, okay, yeah, shoot this scene, and then we're going to like post-process it into something that looks like schlock, you know? And it's like, okay, I mean, that's cool and everything, but like, I want to see a collaboration between Tarantino and Richardson where they're both bringing their A game and not intentionally making the image look bad. And that's what we get with Inglourious Basterds. I think that this is his best photographed movie to date, Tarantino, that is. I mean,
yeah, I can't argue against that. I mean, it is beautiful. Yeah,
the scene which always gets me, which every time I see it, I'm like, oh God, is when they're eating the strudel.
Yeah,
and the way that he shoots mm-hmm. like the cream and everything, I'm like, yep. Oh my God, I need to eat some strudel.
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, again, you see Tarantino getting, you know, I didn't know who Christoph Waltz was. I doubt many people knew who Christoph Waltz was before this, but finding the right actor for that part, getting that performance out of him, and never mind the fact that something I didn't even really, I mean, you notice, but you don't really think about, but because, you know, we're going back and we're doing the rewatch, trying to have, you know, pick out certain things, how incredibly mind-blowing it is and rare for an American director to have a multilingual film.
Yeah, and like, he's talked about that.
An appropriately fluent one, too, where they're actually speaking the languages. Like, it's crazy.
Right.
How, it's amazing.
He's talked about that a lot, you know, in regards to this movie and how, you know, one of the things which he finds super fascinating about World War II is that language played such a key role in, you know, in the war, you know, where you had like spies and stuff like that, people interacting, and your mastery of a language could be the difference between life and death. And, you know, that plays out, you know, perfectly in that scene in the cafe in the basement, you know, and it's amazing. But because of that, you know, he did want to cast actors who were, you know, native to the countries that the characters were from in order to get that authenticity. So he, you know, he was shooting, I think they were shooting, I'm assuming they actually did shoot in like France and stuff like that. But
yeah, I'm pretty sure they did.
You know, so, I mean, they were shooting in Europe for sure. And, you know, he wanted European actors, you know, to play these roles. And, you know, that's how he found Christoph Waltz, who, yeah, had been in a bunch of German stuff that was not at all big. No one knew who this guy was, no one at all. And Tarantino found him, put him in this movie, and he won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. And he's worked with Tarantino ever since and has you know, gained a career. And, I mean, you look at Waltz's performance, like, in that first scene, right? And, I mean, if you think of this as, like, his first movie, in a sense, you know, obviously he had worked forever, but first movie on a, you know, large scale, like, he is so sure of himself.
Mm-hmm.
He has such a mastery of the craft. And for someone to just come in, someone who we in America have never heard of before, this brand new face to come in and literally just amazing, you know? It's unbelievable.
It is. And he, you know, you're right. There's the mastery there, but I also have to give him, Tarantino, so much credit for having Pitt in the type of role that he is, because I really think Pitt, he's a great actor, but this is the type of role I always want to see Brad Pitt in, the offbeat role. Ever since he played against type for the first time with 12 Monkeys, and everybody saw him and said, whoa, hey, this is not just, you know, pretty long hair Legends of the Fall guy. This is something special here. And, you know, and then there's Fight Club and there's all of this. And the role that he plays in this is so, like, Tarantino gets that trademark necessary quality for a Tarantino film out of him. And that scene as well, because, you know, talk about Pitt and Waltz, that scene where Waltz effortlessly switches over to Italian and starts talking to them in the lobby and gets, you know, Brad Pitt to, you know, to say his cover name three times just to drill into him, like just to give that little needle of like, I figured you out and I'm just going to string this along. And like, you don't know who's going to break and who knows what at this point. And it's just, it's brilliant. But also we see a recurring item with Tarantino again in an extremely strong female lead who is the difference, who is the hero of the film.
Yeah. Yeah. And that character is played by Melanie Laurent. And to me, she just steals this movie. I mean, it's called Inglourious Basterds. Brad Pitt is the leader of the bastards, and his name is, you know, above the title on the posters and all that stuff. But to me, Melanie Laurent is clearly the lead in this movie. I don't know. I mean, it's weird in that it has that sprawling narrative where it has different chapters, just like, you know, Kill Bill, same font and everything. And it'll follow like one set of characters, and there'll be like a scene told from this person's perspective, and then we won't see them again for another half an hour or whatever. But to me, like, she's the driving force in this movie, and she's so good, you know? And, you know, the character that she plays, Shoshana, she is, you know, well, I mean, I guess for those people who don't know, she's a character whose family, she's a Jewish character whose family is killed by Christoph Waltz's character in the first scene of the movie. And now, you know, like 4 years later, she's hiding in France. She's running a movie theater, changed her name and everything like that. And now her path crosses again with Christoph Waltz. And I don't know. I love that character so much. Maybe part of it is just because she runs a movie theater, and you know.
Yes. Let's talk about that too, because of course something that I didn't really give a lot of weight to the first time I watched Inglourious Basterds, but that I did this time, was Tarantino takes great care to highlight how the process worked for film, and having Sam Jackson narrate the section about, you know, nitrate film being extremely flammable and everything, but having everything set up and having her and her projectionist walk through, you know, this reel is here and that reel is there, and even having, you know, the reel change item, you know, the little bell ring, mm-hmm. to give them the indication and everything. It's, I imagine that for you, it's a lovely, you know, sequence in the film because there's great care. Did he miss anything? Was there anything incorrect about the process that he highlighted?
Not really. I mean, it's pretty spot on. You know, that's basically exactly how it is. The only thing which is weird is, you know, the guy, Marcel, her projectionist, is like, reel one is on projector one, reel two is on projector two, reel three is on the bench, and reel four is in the can. And it's like, okay, but why is reel three on the bench? And also, like, it's like a rewind bench where you can go, basically you can wind the film from one reel to another. And I mean, I guess maybe he stopped because she came up, but it's like, why is the reel like halfway wound? it's just a random thing. Like, why would anybody just leave a reel like that? That doesn't make any sense. But
and I can guarantee you that myself and anybody else who watched this for this week just said, huh, I didn't notice that. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about you, man, is like that. That's that little thing that I never would have caught in a million years.
The other thing which bothers me, but, you know, I mean, whatever, I guess people do this, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm sure I have done this to a million projectionists myself, but, you know, the guy's like, I threaded reel one. And, you know, they have like carbon arcs, you know, which they would use for the lamps, where it was literally like a rod, you know, which was burning, and you'd have to like change them, you know, because they would like just burn out. And then, you know, you need to put a new one in and you got to focus it and everything. So with the projector threaded, she opens up the lamp house and like looks inside and like turns a knob or something like that. And I'm assuming that was to like focus the light or whatever. I don't know. I mean, like, clearly the guy had set it up. Why is she messing with what he did? But, you know, whatever.
It's a bit of stage business that shouldn't happen, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Although that being said, I'm sure I've done that a million times myself. You know, like, oh, yeah, I threaded it. Okay, that's good. And then I look at it, and it's like that scene in The Abyss where Lindsay's, like, walking through the rig, and there's like a little knob and she twists it, and then, you know, Ed Harris just twists it back.
Yes. I know exactly. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
But But yeah, I mean, this is one of the, if not the most accurate portrayal of film projection I've ever seen in a movie. And yeah, Shoshana is definitely my favorite movie projectionist because of basically what she does in this movie, which is pretty awesome, you know? I won't that spoil is. It, but yeah, it's pretty cool.
I have to ask you, though, that during some of the crazier times, have you ever dreamed of doing what Shoshana did with an audience that didn't behave?
No, because, you know, when you're a projectionist, it's you're up in the booth and all you're doing is making sure that the movie is running and what the audience is doing down there is really none of your concern, you know? You're just making sure that it's all good for them. But the stuff with, like, the nitrate film, like, that is accurate, too. Like, that stuff was extremely flammable, and yeah, it would go up just like that, so much so that, you know, even just like 10 years ago you would see signs posted on doors leading up to projection booths which say safety film only, which is basically, you know, like, you know, film which is not nitrate, you know, now it's made out of like polyester and everything, which will melt or whatever, but it won't ignite into, you know, flames. And it's like, okay, yeah, safety film only. Yeah, that's good. That's a good sign to have up in this multiplex where they will never, ever show a nitrate film. It's very, very rare that nitrate films are still shown. I know that the Dryden House or something like that, basically at the Kodak Eastman Library, whatever, headquarters in Rochester, New York, they do like a lot of screenings of like old, like archival prints and stuff like that. And they do some, and they have like occasionally, like maybe once a year, they have like a nitrate film festival or something like that. But it's a big deal, you know, and they're taking like a million precautions to make sure that the whole place doesn't, you know, blow up.
Do you have to sign a waiver just in case?
Probably, yeah. But, but yeah, they say that nitrate prints and with carbon arc is amazing. They say that the look of that is unlike anything you've seen today because, you know, you can't, but they just say,
well, now I want to go up to the Kodak place and watch it, Mike.
I know, me too. I'm very curious to know what it looks like because, you know, it's hard, you know, when people are describing it, what does that mean? But so, yeah, I mean, I definitely think Inglourious Basterds is worth watching. I'm guessing you do too, right?
To pick a line from Brad Pitt, at, you know, in the film, it's a masterpiece. So,
yes, and it's you know, I mean, we're not the only ones who think so. It was nominated for Best Picture, and Tarantino was nominated for Best Director and Best Screenplay, and Robert Richardson was nominated for Best, you know, Cinematography, which is noteworthy because, with the exception of Death Proof, which Tarantino photographed himself, all of Tarantino's movies for the past 15 years have been photographed by Robert Richardson. So it's only reasonable to assume that he would shoot this Star Trek movie, which it's like all my dreams come true. Richardson is amazing. He's won 3 Oscars. He won them for JFK, The Aviator, and Hugo. And he's one of the very, very, very best in the business. So
I didn't realize he'd done JFK.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That movie is phenomenally shot.
It is.
Yeah. That is a movie, even before I knew how to appreciate cinematography, I knew how to appreciate the way that film looked.
Yeah.
So that is for sure. And The Aviator too. It was really good in The Aviator.
Oh yeah. He's good. A really good looking film. Of his movies are just stunning. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Hugo shot in 3D, you know. Cool.
Haven't seen Hugo. Have to.
It's pretty good.
I will.
Yeah. It's not great. Pretty good. It's good to watch
with the kids. At least I know it looks good.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good to watch with the kids, you know.
Cool.
Get some film history in there, you know. So, anyway, it's been fun talking about Inglourious Basterds today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Warp 5.
Like, Mario is not a good person, and I don't like him, but when he openly mistreats Luigi is when I hate him, is when I make the decision I don't want him to make it through this. I don't want him to make it to the end at all.
The orb.
That blanket really helped the show because it didn't end up turning into what Voyager did, which is we got to launch a network. This has to be this. It has to be put in a box that we can't get out of, you know, like Deep Space Nine takes the box, crumples it up and throws it in the corner.
The 602 Club.
I love it. Have I said that enough? I think I said earlier that I was waiting to get to Timothy Dalton. Not to knock on Roger Moore, but I didn't like Roger Moore as much as I liked Dalton and then Connery and then Craig.
The Ready Room.
Since early 92, I was lucky enough to get the contract to do the companion for Next Generation. Went out for a week to LA when DS9 was still very, very secret. And my first glimpse of DS9 was knowing that they were working on it. And, you know, like the script was being passed around in unmarked envelopes between the offices.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app, and get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place is to join the larger conversation in the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's our listeners group. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and we should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and select Stage 9. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me as Castle Junkie on your social network of choice. You can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And over on the Nerd Party Network, you can find me co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matthew Rushing and Great Shot Kid with you.
Yeah, you can find me over there. And you can also find me right here on Trek.fm doing a show called The Edge. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network at Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. All right, well, that's Inglourious Basterds, the first film in the Quentin Tarantino Western trilogy, as it were.
Yes.
Next week, we're going to take another look at history through the eyes of Quentin Tarantino with Django Unchained.